You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today, if you followed American politics over the last 20 or 30 years, as I have, you'll be very familiar with my guest. He brings experience in broadcast journalism on TV and radio, including locally, which I didn't realize till I made contact with him. He's also been involved in education as an adjunct professor. And more recently, he's been involved with the Center for Bipartisanship in the nation's capital. He's Steve Scully. And most of you probably remember him from a long and distinguished career as I do at C-SPAN. Currently, Steve is Senior Vice President with the Bipartisan Policy Center. And he also hosts a weekday show on the POTUS channel on Sirius XM satellite radio, which I listen to regularly. It's called The Briefing. And I'm really delighted to have Steve as a guest today. Steve, thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invite. And I should tell you that when I was at Northwestern as a graduate student, I worked with WHBF in the Quad Cities. So I have a local connection there. I had been in the town on a couple of occasions. I was working in Washington. So perhaps somewhere in the archives of WHBF, there are some Steve Scully stories from many years ago.
You know, all roads run through the Quad Cities, so I wasn't surprised by the connection there. I remember you with C-SPAN, Brian Lamb. I mean, that was an excellent channel. I remember when it first became popular. I guess I'm old enough to remember that. But it was really regarded, I think, and it still is, as a nonpartisan source of news and interviewing. I remember your style. I saw where you've interviewed every president since Gerald Ford. That's quite an honor. What are some impressions of the various presidents you've talked to, and who perhaps did you find most intriguing?
So I should point out they were not all president when I interviewed them. Gerald Ford, for example, was a former president with Ronald Reagan, though he was in the White House. I was a local news reporter, had the chance to do an interview with him, and then the other presidents when they were in office. You know, they're all different and interesting, and they all stand out. I can tell you, I mean, there are many, many stories. When I was interviewing President Gerald Ford in 2000 in Philadelphia, he had been in Philadelphia in 1940 as kind of a young rebel Republican. That was, of course, Wendell Willkie. And in 2000, the nominating George W. Bush. But during the middle of the interview, he literally had a stroke, a mini stroke, a TMI. Boy. We're talking about Iran and global threats. And then he turned into onions and hamburgers. It was really an odd moment. And I was kind of puzzled as I looked at him. And then he snapped out of it. He was fine. He left. And then he had another stroke later that evening in Philadelphia and was rushed to the hospital. So Brian was there. He joked with me afterwards. I mean, fortunately, the former president was fine, and he lived for many years after that, but just an odd moment. One of the most memorable experiences I had, though, was with another president in the Oval Office. And let me set the stage. It was one of his final interviews before leaving in 2008. It was George W. Bush. And I asked for two things. I asked to do it in the Oval Office. And I asked for time. So we had almost 40 minutes, which, as you know, is a lot of time for a president. And it was actually the same day that he was having lunch with the then vice president, Dick Cheney, and saying, I'm not going to pardon Scooter Libby. I didn't know that at the time, but that was the date. And so I put that together. But one of my approaches is really what Brian Lamb does, what Tim Russert has done so well, is to use the words of the individual to try to generate news, to make it a conversation. Not to play gotcha journalism. And if you have the time to do the interview, then you have the time to really have that conversation. And so one of the moments during the interview, I was asking him, as you know, 2000, Bush v. Gore, and Al Gore conceded the race graciously. George W. Bush basically was saying, I want to be a president who binds the wounds of this campaign and brings the country together and unites America. And I read that to him in the prism of 2008, deeply divided. And I said, Mr. President, what happened? And he kind of slumped back in the chair in the Oval Office. It was almost like the air had come out. And he said, I guess I was a more hopeful person back then. And he talked about the divisions in the country and social media, which was still in its infancy, cable chatter. And it was a really interesting moment because you could get him to really reflect in an honest and candid way about what his presidency was really like. So that's always been my approach. And, you know, Barack Obama was complicated to interview because he's very lawyerly. Donald Trump is a hard interview because you ask him a question about X and you get Y and Z. So all of them are different, but they are best when you have the time and the ability to have a conversation, which is what I've tried to do.
Yeah, I like your style. I try to emulate your style to some degree. I try not to be confrontational. Ask good questions and let my guests talk. And I really think there's a hunger for that out there because in our cable culture, we've got the gotcha journalism, so to speak, and on both sides. I wanted to ask you how we've all got our own opinions. And anymore, I see it, and I'm sure you see it, where a lot of journalists aren't shy on social media of sharing their thoughts on things, and they give away kind of what their political persuasions are. How challenging is it for you to keep your own biases and opinions out of interview topics?
So it's not that hard. I mean, look, when I approach an interview, I want to, you know, I want to try to take the other side. I want to challenge them. You know, I'll give you a way of how I deal with it, for example, with Donald Trump. So about a month ago, he was saying that the Democrats and Barack Obama did nothing during his transition in 2016. And, you know, I've done more to try to help the transition. And I hope that when I'm elected, Biden gives me that courtesy, which, of course, we know what happened in 2020. So how I deal with that, and I dealt with this on Sirius XM, is, okay, but I was in the Oval Office 2 days after the election in 2016 when Barack Obama welcomed Donald Trump, then the president-elect. And, you know, it was a small pool of reporters. And I remember it like it was yesterday because my impression of Trump is he could not believe he won the election. He's looking around like, this Oval Office is going to be mine. And look, Barack Obama was, I'm sure, pretty ticked off that that Trump won. He clearly wanted Hillary Clinton to carry on his legacy. But he was very gracious. And he said, just like George W. Bush gave me the tools during my transition, I intend to do the same for Donald Trump. And if he succeeds, the country succeeds, something like that. So I played what Trump was saying just about a month ago. And then I played what Obama said back in 2016. So just deal with the facts. You know, when I was at Northwestern, and other college professors have said this as well, don't tell me what you think, tell me what you know. And I guess that's been ingrained in me. And of course, at C-SPAN, not once did I ever express an opinion. Now, people can perceive an opinion based on a question, you know, oh, you're a liberal Democrat. Oh, you're a, you know, conservative Republican. Oh, you're in Trump's camp. Oh, you hate Trump, you know, based on whatever they see and hear. And so if I get it from all sides, then I know I'm kind of in the middle and I'm doing a pretty good job. But it is hard. Yeah. You're right. It's hard on, you know, you tune into cable TV and they're trying to reinforce the narrative. And what I try to do and try to do at C-SPAN as well is to, you know, give people an alternative and present the facts, challenge the guests on both sides of the aisle and let them make up their own mind.
I think that's admirable, and I would encourage our listeners, and I think a lot of our listeners are looking for the same sources, listening to public radio, that is kind of what we're wanting instead of just the screaming matches. You mentioned social media, and I remember, like you do, the time before social media took over. I mean, first we had cable TV come, and then we had all these other networks, MSNBC and CNN and Fox, and in the advent of social media, that just seems the promise of it was to help democracy. Do you think it on balance, it's still helping democracy, or do you think it's right now overall on balance, it's hurting our democracy?
So the good news is there's more news and information outlets out there than ever before. The bad news is there's more misinformation from outlets than ever before. We will never go back, nor should we go back to the days where we had three choices and we all got the same news from ABC, NBC, or CBS. It is a much better environment today. It is terrific that C-SPAN can carry events live and in their entirety, you make up your own mind. It's great that we have opinion programs on Fox and MSNBC and CNN. The problem is, are you a good consumer of news and information? So I tell students, if you're a progressive Democrat, You need to read the Wall Street Journal editorial page. You need to watch Sean Hannity. You need to watch Newsmax to understand where they're coming from. And conversely, if you're, you know, a conservative Republican, you need to also watch a Rachel Maddow. You need to read the New York Times. So you're not basically regurgitating the same point of view. And that's where the problem is you have people who go to these channels. And look, I'm from a very big family. I've got Bernie Sanders in my family, and I've got Elizabeth Warren in my family, and I've got Donald Trump in my family. So it's a very disparate group. And we try to navigate. Sometimes we say, let's not talk politics, because it can get really tough at times. But I tell my own family members, you know, understand what the other side is all about. For example, the Donald Trump supporters, who are these supporters? They're good Americans for the most part. They have a really strong point of view. You can't put them in the basket of deplorables bucket like Hillary Clinton did in 2016. And Joe Biden, I think, is a very decent guy. I don't think, you know, he's got a mean bone in his body, and yet he gets a lot of criticism. But understanding where they're coming from, and you do that, I think, by being open, even though you may disagree with one point of view or another, do it in a, you know, in an agreeable way. That's what we try to do here at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
That's a great segue into my next question. I wanted to ask you about that. Could you share with our listeners a little bit what it is, what its mission is, and what kind of services programs you offer?
So it was formed about almost 20 years ago. The idea first came about by four former Senate Republican and Democratic leaders, including Tom Daschle and Bob Dole and George Mitchell and Howard Baker. And they wanted a place in which they did two things. First of all, they were Democratic and Republican Senate leaders, but they knew that the only way you got meaningful change in this country is by working together, by having compromise. And yet without, you know, taking away their strong points of view about, you know, issues like abortion or debt and deficits or taxes or whatever. So it was formed here with the idea that we're going to try to bring all sides together, have that fierce debate, and look for areas of common ground. Having bipartisanship in your word is not a bad name. You're not a rhino if you're supporting Democratic causes. You're not a fake Democrat if you're working with Republicans. And so what we try to do is to foster that ability to have the civil dialogue. Because let me put this in very clear terms. We are in an election year. A whole lot's not going to happen. The immigration vote that happened recently failed because it became a political issue. But in 2025, you have to think about this. You've got the Trump tax cuts that are coming up next year. You've got a $35 trillion national debt that has to be addressed. You've got to raise the debt limit. Social Security is going to basically go bankrupt in 9 years if it's not resolved. Medicare and Medicaid need to be addressed. Immigration needs to be addressed. These are really big issues. And the only way it's going to come about, and I'll make the only political prediction I'll make is that who's ever in the White House, there will be divided government in Washington. One party may control the House, another party may control the Senate, and there'll be either Joe Biden or Donald Trump in the White House. They've got to come together on these big issues. Let the politics work its way out this year, and that's what we try to do here every day. We have a lot of projects, a lot of programs. We have a Senate project debate. We're doing two this year. One, if I can put a plug in late June, on June 27th, Senator Cassidy, Senator Whitehouse, talking about climate change, energy, taxes, environment. We have another one set for September the 17th that will air on Fox News. That will take place here in Washington. So we want to have players who are in the arena debating the issues, understanding their points of view, and then where possible, look for areas of common ground. It's as simple as that.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest today, Steve Scully. Many of you know him from his C-SPAN days, and he's now on satellite radio on the POTUS channel, hosting The Briefing, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And Steve's just been talking about his work with the Bipartisan Policy Center located in Washington, D.C. It's strange because we've never met, but it's like talking to an old friend. I've watched you so much, and in recent years when I travel, I listen to The Briefing, you've got a calming effect in how you talk and how you interview your guests, and I guess it's comforting to hear.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Robin. Well, thank you for listening, and thanks for being a C-SPAN follower. I think I have about 8,000 interviews in the video library, but it's great to talk to you.
One thing that stood out to me was in reading about you is your background. You're from Erie, Pennsylvania, which political geeks like me know is an Obama-Trump county. Erie County is located in the northwest part of the state, far northwest part of the state. It's one of the very few counties that voted for Obama twice, then Trump, then Biden.
Mm-hmm.
How was your upbringing there? That's interesting to me because that county symbolizes, I guess, based on that kind of the bipartisanship you're talking about. It's a swing county. Did that growing up in that area have anything to do with your views today on bringing the parties together?
Well, it's a swing county, and let's be honest, in a very swing state. Dr. Joe Biden is going to be in Erie in early June to deliver a commencement address at the local community college, and it's getting a lot of attention. Trump's been there a couple of times just in the last year. He was there. I know President Biden intends to be up there as well. It's a great town. You know, I grew up in a large Irish Catholic family. I have 12 brothers and sisters, 5 sets of twins with my mom and dad. And, you know, the neighborhood was full of large families. But when I was growing up, it had a lot of industrial plants. You know, I would say, hey, Dad, what's all that smoke coming from the chimney? He goes, those are all called jobs. And he was a manufacturer's rep. And so he was able to work at plants like General Electric, which is now Wabtec. They make locomotives in Erie. But other companies have left. American Sterilizer, Hammermill Paper was a big employer. That's shut down. So it's really gone through a lot of transformations. And as we look at the changes within the Republican Party becoming much more blue collar MAGA Republican Party, because Trump's been very effective in going after those supporters, that is reflective in Erie. And Erie's also trying to transform itself in terms of new technology. It has a beautiful bay, Presque Isle Bay and Lake Erie. The beaches in Erie are terrific in the summer. So a plug, if you want to travel through there, if you're en route from Cleveland to Buffalo, stop by. There's some great places to go hiking. The bayfront is really coming alive, restaurants and everything else. So it's struggling, but it's getting better. And I think that is where the country is and where the Rust Belt states are, like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, which is why they're such such important states in this election. They will determine whether Joe Biden or Donald Trump is our next president.
It's Erie County, like most of these Obama-Trump counties, had a history of manufacturing that declined, I've noticed, and that's a commonality across the Midwest. And as you say, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, the blue wall states, it's going to be crucial this year. That I think those three states are again going to determine the president.
I think you're right. It's interesting because I look at the polling, and as you listen to the program, you know, I always say, hey, poll is just a snapshot. It's not exact. It doesn't mean this is what's going to happen. We're five and a half months out before the election. But let's be honest, in most of the national polls, Donald Trump is up. He was never up in 2020 and certainly was never up in 2016. But I thought abortion was going to be a bigger issue. Perhaps it will be. But look, to quote James Carville, it's the economy, stupid. I mean, people are seeing it. Even though the numbers are good, the economy is doing well, the stock market is doing well, unemployment is down, inflation has dropped, but we're all feeling it. When we go to the grocery stores, my wife every week is like, I can't believe how expensive this is or that is, or my bill is $50 higher this week. And gas prices are, you know, they're stable, but they're getting a little bit higher. And that's what people are seeing. And that's why it's so reflective in the polls. You know, John Kennedy once famously said, you know, in victory, there are many fathers, and in defeat, you're an orphan. So when you're losing out in the economy, who do they blame? They're going to blame the president.
Let's talk about your show on POTUS, the briefing. You began in 2022. What is there any difference between being on TV and then switching over to radio? I was just curious because it seems like maybe there's not much of a difference in how you prepare, or perhaps there is.
You know, I think radio is the most intimate and visual medium out there. And look, you're in the business, so you know that, because you have a captive audience. You know, I have televisions in my office here, and I have CNN and Fox and MSNBC on, but it's just on. I'm not really watching it unless there's a breaking story. And I know that if I'm home watching the news, I might also be reading the newspaper. Or, you know, my daughter might come in or something. You're distracted. But when you're in the car listening, which is where most of our audience is, you're pretty much tuned in to that conversation. And the one nice thing is I can have a little bit more personality on Sirius XM. We really try to button it down on C-SPAN, which is fine. But, you know, I can, you know, show a little bit more emotion or whatever. And the great thing about the briefing is that the folks at Sirius XM in New York, they've been terrific to work with. Dave Gorab, who is the vice president of talk radio for Sirius and the POTUS channel, has really given us free rein to take the ball and run with it. So you might remember Chris Cuomo had the show before me. And after he left, they said, we don't want another Chris Cuomo show. We want a Steve Scully show. And so if you listen to the program, my mantra is, you know, more sound, less talk. Let's hear from all the players. So sandwiched between what Michael does on his program, Michael Smirkanish, which is terrific, a lot of calls, a lot of engagement, you know, issues that he wants to talk about. And then you've got other programs like Dan Abrams and you've got Julie Mason. But my show is kind of in the middle, and we call it The Briefing because we want to brief you on everything that's happening in Washington and around the country and take a deep dive on some of the major topics. And, you know, today was immigration, and, you know, next week could be much more on the polling numbers, interesting columnists from all sides, members of Congress. You know, just the other day, we had Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, Democrat from Nevada, and Senator John Thune, Republican. He's vying for the Senate Republican leadership. So we provide balance as best we can and, you know, give enough time to get the issues out there. But it's not a half hour, 45 minutes interview like it would be on C-SPAN. It would be 8, 10, 12, 15 minutes, a little bit longer if it's a book interview. You know, I just did an interview with Susan Page on her great book about Barbara Walters, Doris Kearns Goodwin on her great new book on the 1960s. It's a must read if you live through the 60s or want to better understand. So I love doing that. And then when I do these interviews, I always try to weave in some of the sound of the players or the people that these authors are talking about to bring their voices to the program.
I'm glad you mentioned that because do you enjoy interviewing elected officials more or book authors? I mean, it seems to me that you know, the elected officials bring a certain perspective and certain type of questions you can ask and dig around a little bit. Authors, it's more I don't know. It seems more you can be a little more creative and getting them to talk about their work. But do you have a preference?
You know, they're different. And I'm pausing because if I get a really good author, I want to spend time with them. I want 20, 25 minutes to really take a deeper dive on the topic. The problem with politicians is that they have their own talking points. And so what I've tried to do, first of all, with every member that comes on, every member of Congress, they have an issue that they're working on. So with Senator Thune, for example, his big issue, understandably, and for your audience in the Midwest, is the Farm Bill. So I really wanted to kind of break down the details of the Farm Bill, and you could tell his excitement to talk about something besides, you know, Donald Trump or stuff like that. And that's going back to your question about, you know, cable television, you know, it's all Trump all the time. So I like doing that when we can really take a deeper dive and explain an issue. What I don't like is when you have that member on and you know they're just going through the talking points. And it's one of the things the challenges about the Sunday shows is that if you have, you know, a member of Congress or an administration official appearing on all four or five shows, they basically are on because they want to have the same answers. So how do you break through on that is often a challenge. And, you know, when I was at C-SPAN, we always tried to get somebody other when I was doing newsmakers than the newsmaker that Face the Nation or Meet the Press was going after, because we knew that we wouldn't get anything new. But public officials are hard simply because they're, you know, worried about the next election and they want to be careful with what they're saying. And, you know, you want to break some news when you can. I did do an interview, speaking of Illinois, with Senator Dick Durbin a few months ago, and he got very animated over some issues with the U.S. Supreme Court and broke some news that morning that, you know, he didn't intend to break. So when you get that, you know you scored something.
The last topic I wanted to address here is where we got 2 or 3 minutes left. The Jefferson Educational Society Global Summit that takes place in Erie, where you're from. You've been involved the last 11 years. Is that correct? Could you share a little more information about that, please?
So you talked about how the Erie community is trying to redefine itself. And, you know, I remember years ago as a local reporter, there's a big set of stories, U.S. Steel looking for a new plan. And is U.S. Steel going to come to Erie? That was been talked about. It never happened. My point of mentioning that is the days of big corporations coming in and transforming a city, they're gone. I mean, you have auto manufacturers that have really redefined themselves in the South, but what has to happen, it has to come from within. And there are some core elements in Erie, Erie Insurance, which is one of the Fortune 500 companies, tourism, you know, the lakefront. There's some things that you can hang your hat on that can redefine the city. So I'm a proud resident of Erie. Years ago, they gave me an award, and I've never left. They've asked me to help out every year to try to bring in, you know, people like former President George W. Bush and, you know, leading authors and public officials and members of Congress, people, you know, like Al Hunt and Judy Woodruff just there last fall, John Dickerson of CBS News. And the summit is really designed to really focus on getting people together to talk about issues and to give the community something to really feel proud about. And I'm glad to have played a part in that. So it's great for other towns to learn from what the Jefferson has done, small and mid-sized communities, to really try to make a difference from within.
Final question for Steve Scully. You mentioned the presidential race. We've got a huge presidential race this fall. If it comes down to one state, which state do you think will be key in deciding the presidency?
Georgia.
Georgia. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to pick one because Nevada now seems to be a bit out of play for the Democrats. That was a state that Biden is eyeing. Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin are going to be key. North Carolina is going to be in play. But I think Georgia could be the state that could tip the balance in what we know right now is going to be a very, very close election.
That's an interesting observation, and we're all going to be watching. Steve Scully has been our guest today here on Heartland Politics. Steve, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. It's been really enjoyable. Steve, if you want to learn more about the Bipartisan Policy Center, go check it out on its website, and also the briefing on the POTUS channel is on at 11 o'clock Central Time, correct?
11 Central, noon East, and as we say, anytime on the SiriusXM app, and the best of airs over the weekend. Hey, Robin, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to be with you, and I share in the Mutual Admiration Society. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.